Hello, this is Kristen at the Healthcare Association. Could everybody please mute their phones by dialing *6 on their phone, please? This is Kristen Schmidt at the New Hampshire Health Committee. Could please make sure that your phones are muted, either by the mute function on your own phone or by dialing *6. We'll be getting started in just a moment. This is Kristen at the Healthcare Center. Muted.
Oh, you had to.
This is Kristen Schmidt at the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Please make sure that you call. You can mute your phone by using the mute button on your phone or by dialing. Can I please ask everybody just to make sure, in order to test that, can everybody who's on the line say the name of your facility?
American House.
Riverwood, Exeter.
Rockingham County Rehabilitation and Nursing Center.
If everybody can, what I'm asking is if everybody could please make sure, and if you say the name of your facility, not muted. So this is, I'm not doing the confusion. I just want to make sure that muted. If you are sure that your phone is muted, if you and can I also verify that we have Laura, please? Do we have
Dr. Chan and Dr. Talbot are present, along with Chief Daly.
Wonderful. Thank you. Welcome to the call. So I am going to turn the call over to Talbot, Dr. Chan. But what I'm asking everybody is, if you have sent an email a few minutes ago, if you have, please email that at nhhca.org. And I will either read that question to the group, or I will call on you during the question and ask the answer period, and ask you to unmute your phone and ask your question. I have Brendan Williams. Anything,
I just want to thank the doctors that are on the line, and also department, including Commissioner Chibinat, for their responsiveness to this crisis and some of the questions that we have, and just their hard work. I know that they're putting in a lot of hard work right now. I know these are very challenged by appreciation, and then yield to their expertise for the rest of this call.
Okay. Please make sure that your phones are muted. And if you have any questions, email those to me at kschmidt@nhhca.org. And with that, I would like to turn the program over to you, Dr. Chan, Talbot, and Chief Daly.
Thank you. We're here.
All right. Good morning. Just as a reminder, there's been a bunch of background noise. If you could please put your phones on mute so we can So my name is Ben Chan. I'm the state epidemiologist at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services, and I'm joined here by a group in the room, including Dr. Talbot and Chief Daly, who oversees our Bureau of Infectious Disease Control and is our incident commander for our COVID-19 public health response, as well as Lee Cheney, who's here in the room, who's the director of our emergency. Hopefully we're all familiar to you. But we appreciate you jumping on a call. We wanted to take a more proactive stance in reaching out to all of you to protect our vulnerable populations from COVID-19. And just for a brief sort of global update, you know, globally there are now close to 170,000 cases of COVID-19. Whereas this epidemic, now a pandemic, really began in China. It has moved outside of China in the last couple of weeks. Cases in countries outside of China than we are coming from within China. That includes, you know, multiple countries throughout Europe. And we're also seeing increasing case counts in the United States at, around the country. So 3,700 cases, and this number is continually increasing on a daily basis. In New Hampshire, Concord, New Hampshire, brought on testing for COVID-19 just a little over 2 weeks ago, and in that time we have tested probably over 400 people for COVID-19. The website, which was updated yesterday morning, reports 380 people we've tested. There were another 90 to 100 people our laboratory was working on testing yesterday. So I think we're well over 400 people in New Hampshire that we've tested. And so far, we have identified 13 people with COVID-19. The majority of these are travel-related, and it's not just international travel. We have identified people running from domestic travel, so there is some risk. Certainly, as the number of cases in the United States increase, for increasing exposure to COVID-19 nationally as well. And then we have a few individuals, three individuals, who are identified direct contact with people with COVID-19. So we have been conducting a rapid response here that has, you know, in the early stages of this, looked primarily at rapid identification and isolation of people potentially infected with COVID-19 so that we can get them out of the public. Do a public health investigation to identify exposed individuals and put those people with direct contact to COVID-19 on self-quarantine so that they can be out of the public space. If and when it's systematic, that is all part of a larger payment strategy and factors in to our health response. But now, as we have seen this virus spreading globally and around the country, now stepping up additional measures to try and mitigate the impact in our community, and particularly those who are more vulnerable and come out of China, that there are certain populations and groups that are at higher risk of complications of COVID-19, right? Most people, most younger, otherwise healthy individuals who track mild illness, they will not require hospitalization. But we know that there are a group of individuals or populations who are more likely to need hospitalization and potential intensive care unit support, potentially even die. This includes people in an older age group, people 60 years of age and older, and people, regardless of age, have multiple chronic medical conditions, including heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, people whose immune system groups that we particularly want to protect. And that's part of the reason for the call we're having today, to discuss some of the relative long-term care facilities to protect the more vulnerable individuals in our populations. And we would like to hear your, you know, concerns and your thoughts and how we can better and evolve our response to this rapidly changing. With that, pause and hearing some background noise, and there's some beeping that's going on that's a little distracting. So I just remind you that if you are not on mute, to please put your phones on mute so that we can hear. Thank you.
Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, and I echo Dr. Chan's comments that we're gathered here today to try to help you implement some of the guidance that's coming fast and furious with increasing recognition that you are on the front lines of our most vulnerable population care. So we want to hear your questions so that we can attempt to translate the guidances into something that's operationable and achieving our ultimate goal of protecting this population. The core document that we commit to keep relevant for you is on our website. The last guidance was March 12th, 2020. We make a strong deference to the CMS guidance, which was updated on March 13th. So the link that's present in the guidance that Mr. Williams sent forward within his leadership purview is accurate at that link. So the CMS guidance now is certainly one that I imagine you're all aware of and digesting, and we look forward greatly to understand how we can support you in these challenging times. There are other documents as well besides our own state guidance, the CMS guidance, of course, the emergency declaration from the governor on March 13th is also one that look to understand how we can embrace these strongly. We are sending around, of course, regular health alert networks. Our last was the number 7, and number 8 will come out today. If you are not on the HAN listserv, please do reach out to us so that we can provide you the most current updates as they come forward. The CDC, of course, also has a guidance for long-term care facilities, which is also referenced in our core document. And just today, I've become aware of something that I think you'll find very helpful, which is the COVID-19 preparedness checklist for nursing homes and other long-term care settings. And this is a simplified, you know, an effort to simplify the tasks before you. So this is a CDC document that's easily identifiable. We'll update our own guidance to include reference to it so you can use it to just make sure you are checking the right boxes at the right time. We are vaulted to the CMS updates, which show that, in fact, we are in a state where facilities should restrict visitation of all visitors except for certain compassionate care situations, such as end of life. There are lots of practical recommendations within that document that I know that you're digesting now. So I wonder if, are there any comments? So with that, we make our recurring request that people put their phones on mute. It is indeed a bit distracting, and we really want to. So just take one more look at devices and make sure that you're on mute if you can. So
to make either using the mute button on your phone or by dialing *6, that would be helpful, please.
So then, can we move to an assisted question and answer session with the goal and the expectation that we may not have every answer for you right now, but we're going to try to synthesize them and provide them to you in an accessible way. So we can begin the discussion now with we keep that background noise down so that we can hear everyone.
Great. So I have some people who have sent some questions in to me. And to minimize background noise, I am just going to voice those questions. So we have one, if a SNF has a positive case, who will dictate which staff must also be quarantined and how will that be determined? The effects of losing a whole floor of staff would be devastating.
I guess I would, I'm sorry, it sounds like somebody's in an ICU with some beeping there, which is a little bit distracting. So, you know, the CDC has put out guidance for how to consider healthcare providers who may have been exposed to COVID-19, meaning what risk category they stratification people may have interacted with people or patients diagnosed with COVID-19. And so not everybody in a facility, if there was a patient with COVID-19 identified, would need to be restricted from work. But there would be likely some individuals who had close or prolonged contact with the patient who would likely need to be restricted from work. Many people may be appropriately managed at a facility if they're or risk contact group. Maybe appropriately managed simply with, you know, routine daily temperature screenings and health monitoring. And so what I would say is that, you know, we would help you determine who might need to be excluded from work because of direct close contact. But all facilities should be developing a plan for how they might monitor employees, you know, staff, for symptoms, for example.
You're going to need to turn the fan.
So, again, we'll just keep saying
if everybody could please make, I have people whose phones are not muted. Please make sure your phones are muted by dialing *6.
Yeah. And to reflect that, the guidance is very helpful and remarkably detailed with regards to understanding that the nature of the exposure. So, exposure is a very complicated term in this epidemic in terms of whether the healthcare provider had the appropriate PPE or they were with some parts of it. So take a look at that because I think that it'll reassure you that there is guidance, and our job is to help point you to it and help you operationalize it.
And this is Beth Daly. I just want to add there's things you can be doing now to be proactive about decreasing the likelihood of having to quarantine healthcare workers. I think the question may have been around colleague exposures. And so you can prevent having to have more widespread quarantining by trying to limit close contact between coworkers as much as possible. I realize this is a tough ask, but making sure you're not having office parties, communal food opportunities, asking people even to social distance, even, you know, in our office, we're trying not to sit as close. When we speak to each other, stand a little bit farther apart. I know this is very challenging in a healthcare setting, but that we need to change our culture around. And so just thinking through that with your staff about how you can try to just from each other in general. And this is our new normal, I think, going forward over the next several weeks to months.
Great point.
We've had several people ask, you mentioned personal protective equipment. We've had several people ask about the shortage of PPE for long-term care facilities and what people can do to obtain the PPE that they need.
First, I'd like to make the comment that the recommendations regarding appropriate PPE are changing. We're learning so much about this virus and the way that it transmits every day. So please do try to stay current with regards to what are the current recommendations to appropriately sample a patient who's a suspect and then also how to manage within facility. But with that, I think that what many are recognizing as potential for shortage of critical equipment. So Lee Cheney. Yeah.
Sure. Good morning. This is Lee Cheney. I'm going to speak with you about the need for PPE. If you are looking for personal protective equipment such as masks, gowns, gloves, face shields, things like that, we would like to have you email your request to esu@dhhs.nh.gov. Maybe we could do minutes. There is very little available. We have just taken from the CDC of PPE that is not going to be used for surgical purposes, but can be used probably in the application that you would be using it. As long as you can send us what you're looking for, we will certainly get back in touch with you and let you know what we can provide for you.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that email again? I'm sorry.
Sure. ES as in Sam at dhhs.nh.gov.
Oh,
and this is Kristen. I will email that out to everybody.
Oh, perfect.
Okay. And please make sure everybody's phones are muted.
I'm using all the emergency plans.
I have the next question. I was hoping some guidance in regards to recommendations for people to stay home if they are experiencing general body aches, cough, et cetera. There's a flood of staff calling out because they have a runny nose and a sore throat and don't have a temperature or cough. When you change the temperature, people symptoms, but my staff were all scared because they were told to stay home if they were symptomatic. As a very small facility, any suggestions or clear guidance for my staff in regards to what symptoms should we absolutely be telling staff to stay home?
bravo. You know, you're hearing the message. If you know that people with respiratory illness should stay out of the public space, and so much more so for our vulnerable population. So kudos to the staff who are hearing this message and self-isolating when they have an illness. In turn, we recognize the challenges in staffing and keeping operations and keeping people safe just by virtue of having the right cadre at work. So the cascade of care to get people who are symptomatic with respiratory illness tested for COVID-19. We have prioritized healthcare workers in this cascade of care. And I see everyone in the room wants to make a comment additionally, so let me defer.
So I just want to make the I think, very important point here that fever is not the defining illness of COVID-19, right? So fever may not be present for several days after the start of illness in someone with COVID-19. And we know that virus can be shed very early in symptoms and even with mild symptoms, such as body aches, you know, fatigue, headache. When someone starts showing those potential early symptoms of COVID-19, they may be infectious with COVID-19, even if there is no fever or shortness of breath, for example, present. And so I think, to Dr. Talbot's point, I think, you know, staff and community are hearing this, and I think it's appropriate for people that are feeling well, regardless of, you know, whether they have fever or not, to be staying home to protect our more vulnerable groups of individuals. You know, taking a very sort of precautionary approach to this, I would say that's appropriate. Now, I do want to recognize that we don't believe that there's large or widespread transmission of COVID-19 at this time, but, you know, these symptoms...
Go ahead, Charlie's going to help you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Whoever's speaking,
I'm on
please
daily, like, public health conference call. So, yeah.
Who's ever just speaking, please call.
Whoever's talking about being on a public health conference call, you are not muted. Please make sure that your phone is muted.
So you know, I think that to protect our vulnerable populations, that people are appropriately taking the steps to exclude themselves from work, even with only mild symptoms, even if there's an absence of fever, and I think that's appropriate in this day and age.
Yep, and again, within our core document, the Bureau of Infectious Disease Control guidance for long-term care facilities put out on March 12th, there's also some sample screening tools that I think you'll find useful, you know, that we're certainly paying attention to the epidemiology, that is, you know, what are the risk factors with regards to travel? And it may be that we face a time where every respiratory illness warrants testing in our healthcare personnel, so to avoid introduction into a facility.
Okay. I have another question related to home health agencies for discharging patients. Should they or should they not come in for assessment as a part of discharge planning?
Sorry, I didn't understand the question. Could you restate it, please?
Yes. So home health agencies at times will come in as a part of the process for discharging a resident back into the community. But many times that requires an assessment by the home health agency before services are set up. So is it still appropriate for the home health agencies to be coming in, or should the facilities be turning those home health agencies away?
I see a clear statement in the CMS guidance that there are exceptions to the restrictions that have been recently modified, of course, to essential healthcare workers. But it also applies to other health workers like hospice workers, EMS personnel, dialysis technicians that provide vital care to residents. There's also an exception for surveyors, but I'll have to get creative. The goal here is to prevent the introduction of this virus into your facility. So when you can function without such persons entering, I would recommend that you do so. So this is not business as normal, and we, again, need to be creative, also using technology. So I think that within the CDC checklist and any of the other documents coming to us, you can see that we're asked to consider creative ways to get our work done. So some of that could be done remotely. What about a video conference with the home health agency? What about telemedicine? Those are all being unrestricted now in ways they had been previously restricted. So let us work with you to see how we can keep this virus from entering your facility in many new and creative ways.
I have another question. I'm not sure if it's appropriate for you, Dr. Chan or Dr. Talbot, but I will voice it. And there might be someone on the line who could answer that. I don't know if Christy Holtz is on the line or Lori. If criminal background checks become additionally delayed due to all of this, will the waiver allow the start of new staff, or do we have to wait even longer?
We're looking around the room for expertise on that here, and just not quite sure the reference. I wonder, does Mr. Williams have any perspective on it, the context for that?
No, we'd really need the department to provide guidance on that. So we can turn to the department and ask that question of them and then get that answer back to our members.
Yes.
So that question would need to be directed to licensing or our legal counsel at the department. Here in the room, we have our Bureau of Infectious Disease Control, and we're not the subject matter experts on that topic.
So that's fine.
That's fine. Thank you. Is there guidance about the directive for communal dining space and group activities? They're an assisted living facility with a separate memory care unit, and they have the ability to social distance all residents. Can they eat together as long as they are 6 feet apart? And do you have recommendations for assisted living facilities that are not set up to do individual tray service?
There's a complexity in that question, obviously. I do draw your attention to the CMS document that has this very clear statement: cancel communal dining and all group activities, such as internal and external group activities. It's really, a new era for us, isn't it? So that's a pretty shocking statement to be at the age of the epidemic. But it underlies, again, that this is not business as usual, and we need to take every precaution to prevent transmission in this population. So then the specifics of that, I think that I'm hearing reference to the fact that this virus transmits through the droplet routes, and there will be a great utility in embracing the understanding of droplet spread. So it's 6 feet, a sneeze, a cough droplet, doesn't really hit somebody else in a longer distance than that. So something was referenced in the question that's going to be vital to consider. And then I don't have any particular advice for those facilities that don't have individual tray service capacity, but it sounds like it might be time to get creative and share lessons between and among facilities that are accomplishing some of these hard asks.
My next question, there's a facility that had to send two key staff members home because they answered yes to being in, and I put in quotation marks, community with positive C-19, such as they live in Boston, and Boston has positive COVID-19 positive residents. Is this something that needs to be adhered to?
Give us one moment, please.
Absolutely.
You know how we can handle it. Break out the purple Kool-Aid. We won't have to worry about it.
All right, we'll back with you to talk this through together.
So this is obviously an area of evolving policy for us. In the guidance that we've issued to you all on Friday, we clearly want you to exclude those areas where staff have traveled to areas that have a level 3 travel notice from CDC. staff who've traveled to other areas could potentially attend work. We all, I think, feel some level of concern about other travel locations, at least internationally. So we do feel strongly that they need to be monitored when they report to work for symptoms. Actively monitored, meaning someone is asking them that they are healthy and that they don't have any symptoms. This could be Auc Health if you have Auc Health, or it could just be their supervisor asking them this question. The challenge with domestic travel right now is that this is, you know, we're learning a lot, and it's challenging, I think, to keep up with where there is sustained community transmission in the United States. And so we have left this as a permissive area for you to implement exclusions where there is sustained community transmission in the United States. We have not come out yet with any, you know, strong statement of excluding healthcare workers for domestic travel yet, but we clearly have some level of concern, especially for those who have passed through airports, people who have returned from conferences. If you have any staff who have gone to a conference where there's been positive identifications of COVID-19, which there have been several now, clearly those people should not be attending work. But we're also hearing that you have concerns about staffing. So I think our message is that there needs to be active screening of people who are traveling. Dr. Talbot, would you like to add anything to my commentary?
I'm hearkening back to your comments that we can do a lot to prevent transmission, even in that dreaded or awful situation where we discover a healthcare worker indeed is if they have been practicing the prevention methods we've talked about, like social distancing, scrupulous hand hygiene, then transmission might be limited. So I just keep wanting to come back to ways that we can facilitate those prevention methods. Get that Purell out on every surface where you can, in every resident's room, enforce as much as you can, and also create a permissive environment for a healthcare professional who can direct patient care to announce that they're not feeling well in the course of a shift. So taking some of our standard messaging, but really ratcheting it up and not allowing any flexibility on some of these prevention recommendations. Indeed, screening people who have traveled, it makes sense. Ask them whether they've been part of a known exposure group, as Chief Daly mentioned, or had contact with anyone in Brazil. I mean, there's flu, there's pertussis, there's metapneumovirus, all those things are still circulating. So these are standard recommendations that we're taking a lot more seriously now, right?
Okay. The next question is related to, you've already discussed the criteria for staff calling out and kind of your kind of guidelines for that. Most of these staff will not be tested for COVID. So they'll need to make a determination without a doctor's visit. It's impossible to tell staff to stay away for 14 days. When can staff return?
I want to come back to something that we've said earlier with regards to our testing guidance. I'm a little surprised to hear to say that those people would not be tested. We've had clearly a bumpy national and translated the local ride with regards to the journey. Please allow that.
If everybody could please make sure that your phones are muted, we are hearing a lot of background noise.
I just want to offer to
you. Dial star 6.
We're really trying to meet the needs of testing, and we would highly prioritize healthcare personnel for testing for COVID-19 in this era. So we don't have the same shortages we did before. We recognize that some of the initial very stringent PPE requirements for testing have been reduced in this era of more data. You know, again, this is droplet transmission predominantly, so you can do nasopharyngeal testing in a closed room, a closed door room. And surgical masks may be an appropriate component of the PPE for getting the nasopharyngeal swab. So, again, the theme here is we want to test your symptomatic healthcare personnel, because that could be a very disabling circumstance if those people either are taken out for 14 days or at work while they're shedding virus.
Is there any consideration in letting medical directors of facilities order tests on behalf of healthcare workers who do not have primary care physicians?
That sounds like a good idea. You know, we even can talk directly with facilities who want to try to do that. But yes, there's a public health purpose for testing healthcare personnel who are in direct contact with our most vulnerable persons. So we'll certainly go out of our way to even help you access testing and get those orders written.
What are the parameters? So once there is a diagnosis of a staff member with COVID-19, what is their return to work after that?
So there's a recent draft document we've seen that's going to help us move from a test-based release from isolation to a time-based release to isolation, but you'll have to allow us to digest that and send it out in our next health communication. So, you know, we're not there now, but when we get there, the guidance will be ready for you on how to release these persons from isolation and get them back to work.
Okay. With
any
I'm just reading through
so far?
The questions.
About what?
How?
Only if you test positive.
If anyone has any additional questions, please email me at kschmidt@nhhca.org. I believe Michael Tommy had a question. If you want to unmute your phone by dialing *6, you may voice that question.
Social isolation.
Could I have that address again, K. Schmidt?
Yes, KSCHID, D as in David, T as in Tom, NZH.org. All those are people who are Paul. Those are all the questions that I have received thus far.
Okay. And at the ready to receive your usual mechanisms.
Address for the questions again, please.
Kristen, I have one more question. It's Rosemary, and I don't have time to cool. May I?
Please go ahead, Rosemary.
My question is if we're doing our screening of employees and they're non-vaccinated, but since they've been back, say they're day 5, and the community that they came from is now changed to a level 3 or has changed to sustained community transmission, at that point, should they self-quarantine?
It sounds like there's a specific context you have in mind, and it's a little hard to make a general statement about that, but maybe one thing is that we certainly believe that the announced epidemiology probably lags behind the community reality. So given, again, this overriding principle of our goal to protect your vulnerable populations, we would likely err on the side of being more conservative with regards to quarantining if it seems a person has come from a high level of uncontrolled community transmission. So if you have a specific question, perhaps call us back to that through usual consult mechanisms. I also wanted to make the announcement that we are having a open line between our subject matter experts at Thursday at 12 to 1. So that's going to be announced again in our HAN. So please do avail yourselves of that if additional questions come up to you that can be asked in a public forum. Are there any final comments or questions?
Do you have any recommendations for screening new admissions?
Kristen, we do have a question from Havenwood Heritage Heights.
Someone else just asked another question. Unless that person was with you, Mike.
I know there's a statement for screening incoming residents. So these are the same standard questions regarding any particular risk factors for where, you know, whether they have had known contact with a case, which is going to become more relevant as time goes on, but also the presence of respiratory symptoms or fever. So I don't think it's anything additional to that. I would make a comment that we don't recommend testing asymptomatic persons. That's not an appropriate use of a test that's designed for people who are symptomatic. So it seems like a good idea, but it's not going to give you the assurance you need, and also it will use precious resources to test asymptomatics.
Okay, can we ask our question, Christian?
Absolutely. Please, Mike.
Okay, go ahead.
So in a CCRC like ours, if we have outpatients that are in our own community, can they come in to be seen, or should our therapists be going out to their cottages, or should we stop seeing them?
Okay. The guidance for medical personnel to continue to provide care is whether it's considered an essential care or not. So that's, I'm not sure how essential the physical therapy for your residents is, and it should be taken on a case-by-case basis. I also want to come back to the clearer statement around admissions. I thought that it's probably useful for you to consider that CMS is suggesting that if possible for new admissions to dedicate a unit or a wing, if they're coming from a place where there might have been transmission, and something like a step-down unit where they stay for 14 days of quarantine. I'm not sure that our community is there yet with regards to unidentified transmission, but that might be coming, so it is within the checklist to consider to prepare for that eventuality. So just to close that loop on that last question.
We have another question. Can we implement mobile testing for long-term care residents to enhance the protection of the residents and avoid ED visits?
So I think that long-term care facilities can implement testing as they're able to at their facility, if that's the question. There are a number of different options available for sending specimens to. We know that LabCorp and Nordics are both currently accepting specimens from New Hampshire locations. Quest Diagnostics is also testing, although we understand their resources are currently diverted towards the West Coast. And then our public health laboratory is accepting specimens as well currently. So the most provider offices are able to conduct the sample collection safely. I'm not sure how this might work in a long-term care facility, but it seems like you likely probably have the PPE, which is just a face mask, gloves, gown, goggles. So it seems like this would be something that you'd be able to do in your facility. And then you would need just the specimen collection supplies, which is just viral transport media and a NP swab, which our public health lab provides to those organizations who are testing through us. And then LabCorp and Nordics have instructions available on their website if you want to test through them.
We have someone who's asked if you could just let everybody know what is the protocol if someone has a suspicion that there's a resident with COVID-19. Who do they call? Do come here to test them, or do they bring them somewhere? If you can go through what the current protocol is.
Sure. We're finding that in our HANS and responding in risk responses, so please do refer. But in general terms, we are essentially normalizing the way that these evaluations happen. That is, we want a person's own primary care provider, healthcare provider, to evaluate a patient and to make a decision about whether testing is warranted. And then the ability to test, as referenced by Chief Daly, it will vary by facility. So we are certainly able to respond to outbreaks in this vulnerable population. Again, we consult with us if you're observing a cluster of unexplained disease, or if you have somebody who has a ILI, influenza-like illness, who otherwise tests negative for the usual suspects, then that of course would raise COVID higher. So we're just really in a new era where we're inserting this new pathogen into our usual clinical diagnostic arena, and we'll try to help you find your way through that, but consult with your medical director, your normal primary care doctor, et cetera, for the decisions on whether to test, and then let us know if you think it's part of an outbreak or indeed in your vulnerable population and in need of special response from public health.
So I have a question about if you have a pending or positive case, a COVID, a resident, can you still perform discharges to the community from the skilled unit?
I don't see any of the issues on their website.
I just want to make sure I do understand that question. So if you have a COVID-19 suspect within your facility, should you halt discharges from others in the facility?
Correct.
If that's the question, I think that we would want to help you take a decision. For example, if the suspect case was an identified alternate exposure and your potential dischargee is someone who is distant and has been socially distant from that potential source, then it might be acceptable. So I'm afraid we're going to fall back to this might be a case-by-case decision that we're happy to engage with you in consultation.
What is the current guidance regarding how long the virus lives on various surfaces and substances? Is there a guidance regarding leaving packages, mails, supplies of time before bringing them into the building or the house?
We are hearing that question, and that reminds me to draw your attention to another living document for your perusal. We've put this question and others that are coming to us like this on our FAQ, which is also on our website. You might want to print that and have that ready at hand. We have pretty clear guidance that there is no perceived risk from packages, from devices, from things that come from outside our state, that this is thankfully a fragile virus that doesn't survive well on surfaces under those conditions of shipping. The other embedded question is one that we're anxiously awaiting the right data on. Right now we have some surrogate data. For example, a recent study came to us where scientists experimentally contaminated surfaces and various kinds of surfaces to see how long the virus survives. And I think it's fair to say that in these experimental conditions, it was hours and in some cases up to just a few days. Normal cleaning will take care of that phenomenon. I'd like to continue to point us to the fact that is not likely driving pandemic, but it's symptomatic people. So your focus, your laser focus on identifying those persons in your facility will be helpful to curtail introduction.
Okay, Kirsten, I got a quick question from a supply point of view. In regards to like the essential supplies like pharmacy, traditionally the individual who supplies them goes station to station and delivers the medications and checks them in. And you support our customers. What is the guidelines in regards to essential individuals coming in for things like pharmacy? Are they tested before they come in for a temperature, or how do you want to handle that?
I'm hearing this as another variation on who is essential personnel, but I think your line is open, so is that correct? Like, who's essential in this day and age?
Essential individuals who are entering, what fair warning can we give them to do exposure, something of that nature?
Yeah, no, I think that's relevant for sure, that everyone coming into your facility, whether your own staff, whether a new resident, whether somebody delivering something that's vital to operations, needs to be subject to the same close scrutiny with regards to the screening questionnaire, and also we've come to a time where it may be appropriate even for temperature checks. Or, do you want to follow that?
Yeah, so in the guidelines, they suggest that they should be dropped off at a dedicated location, and that if you're experiencing illness in your facility, too, that you also protect them,
yeah,
too.
That's right.
So that they don't become ill. But in terms of protecting your population, you want to do the screening that Dr. Talbot mentioned.
Yeah, so again, creative ways to get necessary supplies brought in might be just to bring them to a loading dock and not have a person come in who can be a reservoir of disease. Good points.
Yes, this is Brenda Buttrick at St. Francis. Could I ask a question, please?
Yes, please. Go ahead, Brenda.
Okay. My question is, what should we use for guidance for nursing home residents going out to doctor's appointments, family member visits, anything like that? And my second part of my question is, what about facilities that have independent living centers attached to their building? What should the protocol be for those that are in independent living as far as coming and going from the building and coming back into the building? And some of these people drive. So I'm just looking for guidance on that. Thank you.
Yeah, these are tough new situations we're grappling with together. I would let you know that that I would consider that persons going to healthcare facilities that are experiencing outbreaks, and we don't have those in our state right now, that you should certainly reconsider that visit, and that can be done at the later date when the epidemiology is more clear for a facility. So I'm very enthused by a lot of the momentum toward doing telemedicine, as mentioned earlier. So there may be an imperative, in fact, to make sure that your facility has that capability so that you don't have to take your residents somewhere that might put them at risk and certainly provide you a great deal of operational challenge with regards to the screening on return. Any other comments here in the room? No, sorry. It's a complex question, and we'll leave it there.
I had someone ask a question.
The question about independent living, where a lot of our communities do have independent living attached to their assisted livings. Could we just address those folks in independent living who have cars and visitors and how that should be managed?
The guidance as written may be applicable to that setting, but I think it just depends on the population. The same principles are going to apply where there will be a strong imperative to protect every older adult in our jurisdiction, in the state and in the nation. So whether they're at home in their independent residence or they're in a manner of protected living. Ben, do you want
to? And I think that question goes back to the broader recommendations on social distancing, right?
Okay.
I mean, they're in independent living, and so obviously more control over their environment and surroundings and people that are visiting. And, you know, I think at a minimum there's a role for educating the residents and having processes in place to educate people coming into the facility that if they're sick, you know, even with a runny nose and a sore throat, they shouldn't be visiting. And, you know, I think, you know, messaging some of those social distancing, you know, recommendations that we've put out is going to be important for that community.
And Taylor Salembo, one of our experts in this arena, has brought to my attention the emergency declaration from the governor, which does define the scope of the recommendations with regards to visitation. That it applies to all assisted living, long-term care, nursing facilities, residential care facilities, as those terms are defined in RSAs 151, 151H. So you might look to see if you're you need to be banning visitation and whether you're included in this.
We had a question about.
Can I ask a question, please?
Residents with end of life. Is that something that would still be that would be allowed if there's residents at the end of their life?
this prohibition shall not apply to medically necessary personnel or visitors for residents receiving end-of-life care. So there is an exception made for that. But I did note with a deeper dive into these guidance that if that visitor, even for end-of-life care, is symptomatic, then you would need to make some alternate situation for them to visit their loved one. We would not want to bring any symptomatic person into your facility under any circumstances.
Kristen, this is Tony Maceos. Could I ask a question, please? I can't get through on the other method.
Please.
I'd like to ask a question by example. This morning, this is Tony Maceos, Karen Feralders, Beaver Lake Lodge Assisted Living and Pine Hill Assisted Living, small bed facilities. We have many, many issues on a small scale, but this is a question I think that applies to everyone by example. We had an employee call in this morning that she was experiencing raspy throat, sore throat, and the heck.
I'm sorry. Please continue. Functionally has put us on hold, and I cannot go and mute their line, unfortunately. I know. I apologize for that. Please, if you can continue.
Okay, so Alvin with a sore throat, we told her she needed to go to her primary care. I didn't get. Didn't let her come in because it's one of the symptoms. But why can't we have any of the staff tested immediately? Why can't we send them somewhere protocol where go and get tested?
Your question partially, and it's one maybe we can speak about generally. Thank you for it. There is even, you know, evident frustration in your voice that you can't get testing for somebody that you think needs testing. So clearly this has been a very unexpectedly difficult rollout nationally of testing availability, but the other side of that is also the ability for healthcare facilities to safely test people. So the acquiring the sample is another difficult part of the equation here. We are attempting to overcome that with a volunteer medical service that can provide some community support in a fixed location right now, but there are other models that are being considered. Many of our hospitals are looking to operationalize that what's often called drive-through service, but it is most commonly applicable only to their own patient population. So this is a very dynamic space. Anybody else want to offer their crystal ball, look at what testing is going to be like in a week, in 2 weeks?
So I think the guidance that we're putting out is to reach out to the person's healthcare provider and see if get access to testing through that mechanism. And if you can't access testing through there, you can call us at 603-271-4496, and we can work to schedule you into the mobile testing that is made available in a limited location in the state.
Kristen, this is Suzanne from Havenwood. Next question.
I'm sorry.
This is
Suzanne. If you have a question, you may ask the question, Suzanne.
All right. So we have our nurse practitioner actually asking us right now, if one of our residents needed to be tested, what would they do?
This is the answer that was just provided, that if you have a resident who needs it, then you go through normal medical channels. So you consult the medical provider for that patient for the evaluation. It sounds like if the nurse practitioner is that person and thinks that the testing is needed, they would seek testing through their own usual laboratory support. So it would be either a send out through the commercial laboratory system, or if there's an urgent public health need and testing is not otherwise available, then the number provided, 271-4496, is a place where we can give you the most up-to-date information about where testing may be available to you.
To a nursing home resident? Okay.
I have a question about whether a facility can continue to interview staff in a clean room within the facility, or can they conduct orientation of new staff members in a clean room within the facility?
I think we're all challenged by the background noise. We perceive to be around doing a new staff orientation, and how do you accomplish
yeah.
that?
So basically, could a facility have a clean room separate from the living areas where they could interview new staff or potential staff, or they could conduct orientation for new staff members?
We're going to suggest again that you get creative here. Like, one thing that comes to my mind is that might not have to happen in person at all. Like, is there any amount of orientation or interviewing that can be done remotely? But the point is, the social distancing has become critically important, so you have to be creative in ways to accomplish your necessary functions.
I've had a few questions asking about daycare opportunities, and Brendan has stated that he is looking for some answers to that, so I am not going to address those questions right now. Is one more question about adult day centers, and are they shut?
So I think it's getting a little bit hard to hear and answer these questions with the background music, and it sounds like a lot of people don't. I'm not that question. I'm wondering, you know, if maybe it's worthwhile to set up another call, maybe with operator assistance.
Yeah, a Thursday call soon will be great for follow-on and ways that this has just sparked new areas for discussion. So we remain open to that. And again, please do circulate among your stakeholders. The Thursday noon call will be operator assisted, and it'll be likely better quality in terms of background noise and whatnot. But I think this is the start of multiple times to have in the future as this epidemic unfolds. The salient features here are we prioritize protecting your population. So we're looking for you how the consumer needs additional or comments here. If there any others want to make a comment?
So, Dr. Shannon Talbot, I will connect with you via email after this call. So, thank you for today's call. And if you need, I will do
Conference room, this is Hannah.